Hello, and welcome to Places to Sleep. In every episode, I'm going to read some descriptions of places from books of fiction, mostly fantasy, or books that have lots of really beautiful, lush description. I suggest that you put on a sleep timer and you let yourself drift off to sleep as you picture these places in your mind. Tonight's places are going to come from The Amber Spyglass, the last of the books in his Dark Materials trilogy by Philip Pullman. This is from the chapter entitled Mary Alone. The sun was low over the horizon. The rough track she was following had petered out, and she was clambering with more and more discomfort among tumbled boulders and smaller stones. To her left, the slope fell away toward a landscape of olive and lemon groves, of poorly tended vineyards and abandoned windmills, lying hazy in the evening light. To her right, a scree of small rocks and gravel sloped up to a cliff of crumbling limestone. Wearily, she hoisted her rucksack again and set her foot on the next flat stone. But before she even transferred her weight, she stopped. The light was catching something curious, and she shaded her eyes against the glare from the scree and tried to find it again. And there it was, like a sheet of glass hanging unsupported in the air, but glass with no attention-catching reflections in it, just a square patch of difference. And then she remembered what the I Ching had said, a bypath, little stones, doors, and openings. It was a window, like the one in Sunderland Avenue in Oxford. She could only see it because of the light. With the sun any higher, it probably wouldn't show up at all. She approached the little patch of air with passionate curiosity, because she hadn't had time to look at the first one. She'd had to get away as quickly as possible. But she examined this one in detail, touching the edge, moving around to see how it became invisible from the other side, noting the absolute difference between this and that, and found her mind almost bursting with excitement that such things could be. The knife bearer who had made it at about the time of the American Revolution had been too careless to close it, but at least he'd cut through at a point very similar to the world on this side, next to a rock face. But the rock on the other side was different, not limestone, but granite. And as Mary stepped through into the new world, she found herself not at the foot of a towering cliff, but almost at the top of a low outcrop overlooking a vast plain. It was evening here, too, and she sat down to breathe the air and rest her limbs and taste the wonder without rushing. Wide golden light and an endless prairie or savanna, like nothing she had ever seen in her own world. To begin with, although most of it was covered in short grass in an infinite variety of buff, brown, green, ochre, yellow, golden shades, and undulating very gently in a way that the long evening light showed up clearly, the prairie seemed to be laced through and through with what looked like rivers of rock with a light gray surface. And secondly, here and there on the plain were stands of the tallest trees, Mary had ever seen. Attending a high energy physics conference once in California, she had taken time out to look at the great redwood trees and marveled. But whatever these trees were, they would have overtopped the redwoods by half again, at least. Their foliage was dense and dark green, their vast trunks gold red in the heavy evening light. And finally, herds of creatures, too far off to be seen distinctly, grazed on the prairie. There was a strangeness about their movement that she couldn't quite work out. She was desperately tired and thirsty and hungry besides. Somewhere nearby, though, she heard the welcome trickle of a spring, and only a minute later she found it, just a seepage of clear water from a mossy fissure and a tiny stream that led away down the slope. She drank long and gratefully and filled her bottles, and then set about making herself comfortable, for night was falling rapidly. Propped against the rock, wrapped in her sleeping bag, she ate some of the rough bread and the goat's cheese, and then fell deeply asleep. She awoke with the early sun full in her face. The air was cool, and the dew had settled in tiny beads on her hair and on the sleeping bag. She lay for a few minutes, trapped in freshness, feeling as if she were the first human being who had ever lived. She sat up, yawned, stretched, shivered, and washed in the chilly spring before eating a couple of dried figs and taking stock of the place. Behind the little rise she had found herself on, the land sloped gradually down and then up again. The fullest view lay in front, across that immense prairie. The long shadows of the trees lay toward her now, and she could see flocks of birds wheeling in front of them, so small against the towering green canopy that they looked like motes of dust. Loading her rucksack again, she made her way down onto the coarse, rich grass of the prairie, aiming for the nearest stand of trees 4 or 5 miles away. The grass was knee-high, and growing among it were low-lying bushes, no higher than her ankles, of something like juniper. And there were flowers like poppies, like buttercups, like cornflowers, giving a haze of different tints to this landscape. And then she saw a large bee, the size of the top segment of her thumb, visiting a blue flower head and making it bend and sway. But as it backed out of the petals and took to the air again, she saw that it was no insect, for a moment later it made for her hand and perched on her finger, dipping a long, needle-like beak against her skin with the utmost delicacy, and then taking flight again when it found no nectar. It was a minute, a minute hummingbird, its bronze feathered wings moving too fast for her to see. How every biologist on Earth would envy her if they could see what she was seeing. She moved on and found herself getting closer to a herd of those grazing creatures she had seen the previous evening, whose movement had puzzled her without knowing why. They were about the size of deer or antelopes, similarly colored, but what made her stop still and rub her eyes was the arrangement of their legs. They grew in a diamond formation, two in the center, one at the front, and one under the tail, so that the animals moved with a curious rocking motion. Mary longed to examine a skeleton and see how the structure worked. For their part, the grazing creatures regarded her with mild, incurious eyes, showing no alarm. She would have loved to go closer and take time to look at them, but it was getting hot, and the shade of the great trees looked inviting, and there was plenty of time, after all. Before long, she found herself stepping out of the grass onto one of those rivers of stone she'd seen from the hill. Something else to wonder at. It might once have been some kind of lava flow. The underlying color was dark, almost black, but the surface was paler, as if it had been ground down or worn by crushing. It was as smooth as a stretch of well-laid road in Mary's own world, and certainly easier to walk on than the grass. She followed the one she was on, which flowed in a wide curve toward the trees. The closer she got, the more astounded she was by the enormous size of the trunks, as wide, she estimated, as the house she lived in, and as tall as... She couldn't even make a guess. When she came to the first trunk, she rested her hands on the deeply ridged red-gold bark. The ground was covered ankle-deep in brown leaf skeletons as long as her hand, soft and fragrant to walk on. She was soon surrounded by a cloud of midge-like flying things, as well as a little flock of the tiny hummingbirds, a yellow butterfly with a wingspread as broad as her hand, and too many crawling things for comfort. The air was full of humming and buzzing and scraping. She walked along the grove, feeling much as though she were in a cathedral. There was the same stillness, the same sense of upwardness in the structures, the same awe within herself. This next place is from the chapter entitled Wheels. After 3 days in the company of the wheeled creatures, Mary Malone knew rather more about them, and they knew a great deal about her. That first morning, they carried her for an hour or so along the basalt highway to a settlement by a river, and the journey was uncomfortable. She had nothing to hold on to, and the creature's back was hard. They sped along at a pace that frightened her, but the thunder of their wheels on the hard road and the beat of their scudding feet made her exhilarated enough to ignore the discomfort. And in the course of the ride, she became more aware of the creature's physiology. Like the grazer's skeletons, theirs had a diamond-shaped frame with a limb at each of the corners. Sometime in the distant past, a line of ancestral creatures must have developed this structure and found it worked, just as generations of long-ago crawling things in Mary's world had developed the central spine. The basalt highway led gradually downward, and after a while, the slope increased so the creatures could freewheel. They tucked their side legs up and steered by leaning to one side or the other and hurtled along at a speed Mary found terrifying, though she had to admit that the creature she was riding never gave her the slightest feeling of danger. If only she'd had something to hold on to, she would have enjoyed it. At the foot of the mile-long slope, there was a stand of the great trees, and nearby, a river meandered on the level, grassy ground. Some way off, Mary saw a gleam that looked like a wider expanse of water. But she didn't spend long looking at that, because the creatures were making for a settlement on the riverbank, and she was burning with curiosity to see it. There were 20 or 30 huts, roughly grouped in a circle, made of, she had to shade her eyes against the sun to see, wooden beams covered with a kind of wattle and daub mixture on the walls and thatch on the roofs. Other wheeled creatures were working, some repairing a roof, others hauling a net out of the river, others bringing brushwood for a fire. So, they had language, and they had fire, and they had society. And about then, she found an adjustment being made in her mind, as the word creatures became the word people. These beings weren't human, but they were people, she told herself. It's not them. They're us. They were quite close now, and seeing what was coming, some of the villagers looked up and called to each other to look. The party from the road slowed to a halt, and Mary clambered stiffly down, knowing that she would ache later on. Thank you, she said to her what? Her steed? Her cycle? Both ideas were absurdly wrong for the bright-eyed amiability that stood beside her. She settled for friend. He raised his trunk and imitated her words. Anku, he said. And again they laughed in high spirits. She took her rucksack from the other creature, Anku, Anku, and walked with them off the basalt and on to the hard-packed earth of the village. This last place is from a chapter called Oil and Lacquer. Mary Malone was constructing a mirror, not out of vanity, for she had little of that, but because she wanted to test an idea she had. She wanted to try and catch shadows, and without the instruments in her laboratory, she had to improvise with the materials at hand. Mulefa technology had little use for metal. They did extraordinary things with stone and wood and cord and shell and horn. But what metals they had were hammered from native nuggets of copper and other metals that they found in the sand of the river, and they were never used for tool making. They were ornamental. Mulefa couples, for example, on entering marriage, would exchange strips of bright copper, which were bent around the base of one of their horns, with much the same meaning as a wedding ring. So they were fascinated by the Swiss army knife that was Mary's most valuable possession. Atal, the Zalif, who was her particular friend, exclaimed with astonishment one day when Mary unfolded the knife and showed her all the parts and explained as well as she could with her limited language what they were for. One attachment was a miniature magnifying glass, with which she began to burn a design onto a dry branch, and it was that which set her thinking about shadows. They were fishing at the time, but the river was low, and the fish must have been elsewhere. So they let the net lie across the water, and sat on the grassy bank, and talked, until Mary saw the dry branch, which had a smooth white surface. She burned the design, a simple daisy, into the wood, and delighted at all. But as the thin line of smoke wafted up from the spot where the focused sunlight touched the wood, Mary thought, if this became fossilized, and a scientist in 10 million years found it, they could still find shadows around it, because I've worked on it. She drifted into a sun-doped reverie until Atal asked, what are you dreaming? Mary tried to explain about her work, her research, the laboratory, the discovery of shadow particles, the fantastical revelation that they were conscious, and found the whole tale gripping her again, so that she longed to be back to her equipment. She didn't expect Atal to follow her explanation, partly because of her own imperfect command of their language, but partly because the Mulefa seemed so practical, so strongly rooted in the physical, everyday world, and much of what she was saying was mathematical. But Atal surprised her by saying, yes, we know what you mean. We call it... And then she used a word that sounded like their word for light. Mary said, light? Atal said, not light, but... And said the word more slowly for Mary to catch, explaining. Like the light on water when it makes small ripples at sunset. And the light comes off in bright flakes. We call it that, but it is a make-like. Make-like was their term for metaphor, Mary had discovered. So she said, it is not really light, but you see it, and it looks like that light on water at sunset. Atal said, yes. All the Mulefa have this. You have it, too. That is how we knew you were like us, and not like the grazers, who don't have it. Even though you look so bizarre and horrible, you are like us, because you have... And again came that word that Mary couldn't hear quite clearly enough to say. Something like sraf, or sarf, accompanied by a leftward flick of the trunk. Mary was excited. She had to keep herself calm enough to find the right words. What do you know about it? Where does it come from? From us, and from the oil, was the Tall's reply. And Mary knew she meant the oil in the great seed pod wheels. From you? When we have grown up. But without the trees, it would just vanish again. With the wheels and the oil, it stays among us. When we have grown up. Again, Mary had to keep herself from becoming incoherent. One of the things she'd begun to suspect about shadows was that children and adults reacted to them differently, or attracted different kinds of shadow activity. Hadn't Lyra said that the scientists in her world had discovered something like that about dust, which was their name for shadows? Here it was again. And it was connected to what the shadows had said to her on that computer screen just before she'd left her own world. Whatever it was, this question, it had to do with the great change in human history symbolized in the story of Adam and Eve, with the temptation, the fall, original sin. In his investigations among fossil skulls, her colleague, Oliver Payne, had discovered that around 30,000 years ago, a great increase had taken place in the number of shadow particles associated with human remains. Something had happened then, some development in evolution, to make the human brain an ideal channel for amplifying their effects. She said to Atal, "How long have there been Mulefa?" And Atal said, 33,000 years. She was able to read Mary's expressions by this time, or the most obvious of them, at least, and she laughed at the way Mary's jaw dropped. The Mulefa's laughter was free and joyful, and so infectious that Mary usually had to join in. But now she remained serious and astounded and said, "How can you know so exactly? Do you have a history of all those years?" "Oh yes," said Atal. "Ever since we have had the Sraf, we have had memory and wakefulness. Before that, we remembered nothing." "What happened to give you the Sraf?" "We discovered how to use the wheels. One day, a creature with no name discovered a seed pod and began to play. And as she played, she had no name before then. She saw a snake coiling itself through the hole in a seed pod, and the snake said..." "The snake spoke to her?" No, it is a make-like. The story tells that the snake said, "What do you know? What do you remember? What do you see ahead?" And she said, "Nothing, nothing, nothing." So the snake said, "Put your foot through the hole in the seed pod where I was playing, and you will become wise." So she put a foot in where the snake had been, and the oil entered her blood and helped her see more clearly than before. And the first thing she saw was the Sraf. It was so strange and pleasant that she wanted to share it at once with her kindred. So she and her mate took the seed pods, and they discovered that they knew who they were. They knew they were Mulefa and not Grazers. They gave each other names. They named themselves Mulefa. They named the seed tree and all the creatures and plants. "Because they were different," said Mary. "Yes, they were. And so were their children. Because as more seed pods fell, they showed their children how to use them. And when the children were old enough to ride the wheels, they began to generate the Sraf as well. And the Sraf came back with the oil and stayed with them. So they saw that they had to plant more seed pod trees for the sake of the oil. But the pods were so hard that they seldom germinated. So the first Mulefa saw what they must do to help the trees, which was to ride on the wheels and break them. So Mulefa and seed pod trees have always lived together. Mary directly understood about a quarter of what Atoll was saying, but by questioning and guessing, she found out the rest quite accurately, and her own command of the language was increasing all the time. The more she learned, though, the more difficult it became, as each new thing she found out suggested half a dozen questions, each leading in a different direction. But she pulled her mind after the subject of Sraf, because that was the biggest, and that was why she thought about the mirror. It was the comparison of Sraf to the sparkles on water that suggested it. Reflected light, like the glare off the sea, was polarized. It might be that the shadow particles, when they behaved like waves of light did, were capable of being polarized, too. "I can't see Sraf as you can," she said, "but I would like to make a mirror out of the sap lacquer, because I think that might help me see it." Atoll was excited by this idea, and they hauled in their net at once and began to gather what Mary needed. As a token of good luck, there were 3 fine fish in the net. The sap lacquer was a product of another and much smaller tree, which the Mulefa cultivated for that purpose. By boiling the sap and dissolving it in the alcohol they made from distilled fruit juice, the Mulefa made a substance like milk in consistency and delicate amber in color, which they used as a varnish. They would put up to 20 coats on a base of wood or shell, letting each one cure under wet cloth before applying the next, and gradually build up a surface of great hardness and brilliance. They would usually make it opaque with various oxides, but sometimes they left it transparent. And that was what had interested Mary, because the clear amber-colored lacquer had the same curious property as the mineral known as Iceland spar. It split light rays in two, so that when you looked through it, you saw double. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do, except that she knew if she fooled around for long enough, without fretting or nagging herself, she'd find out. She remembered quoting the words of the poet Keats to Lyra, and Lyra's understanding at once that was her own state of mind when she read the Alethiometer. That was what Mary had to find now. So, she began by finding herself a more or less flat piece of wood, like pine, and grinding at the surface with a piece of sandstone, no metal, no planes, until it was as flat as she could make it. That was the method the Mulefa used, and it worked well enough with time and effort. Then she visited the lacquer grove with Atoll, having carefully explained what she was intending, and asked permission to take some sap. Mulefa were happy to let her, but too busy to be concerned. With Atoll's help, she drew off some of the sticky, resinous sap, and then came the long process of boiling, dissolving, boiling again, until the varnish was ready to use. The Mulefa used pads of a cottony fiber from another plant to apply it, and following the instructions of a craftsman, she laboriously painted her mirror over and over again, seeing hardly any difference each time as the layer of lacquer was so thin, but letting it cure unhurriedly and finding gradually that the thickness was building up. She painted on over 40 coats. She lost count. But by the time her lacquer had run out, the surface was at least 5 millimeters thick. After the final layer came polishing. A whole day of rubbing the surface gently in smooth circular movements until her arms ached and her head was throbbing and she could bear the labor no more. Then she slept. Next morning, the group went to work in a coppice of what they called knotwood, making sure the shoots were growing as they had been set, tightening the interweaving so that the grown sticks could be properly shaped. They valued Mary's help for this task, as she, on her own, could squeeze into narrower gaps than the Mulefa, and, with her double hands, work in tighter spaces. It was only when that work was done, and they had returned to the settlement, that Mary could begin to experiment, or rather, to play, since she didn't have a clear idea of what she was doing. First, she tried using the lacquer sheet simply as a mirror, but for lack of a silvered back, all she could see was a doubled reflection, faintly, in the wood. Then she thought what she really needed was the lacquer without the wood, but she quailed at the idea of making another sheet. How could she make it flat without a backing, anyway? The idea came of simply cutting the wood away to leave the lacquer. That would take time, too, but at least she had the Swiss Army knife. And she began, splitting very delicately from the edge, taking the greatest of care not to scratch the lacquer from behind, but eventually removing most of the pine and leaving a mess of torn and splintered wood stuck immovably to the pane of clear, hard varnish. She wondered what would happen if she soaked it in water. Did the lacquer soften as it got wet? No, said her master in the craft. It will remain hard forever, but why not do it like this? And he showed her a liquid kept in a stone bowl, which would eat through any wood in only a few hours. It looked and smelled to Mary like an acid. That would hurt the lacquer hardly at all, he said, and she could repair any damage easily enough. He was intrigued by her project and helped her to swab the acid delicately onto the wood, telling her how they made it by grinding and dissolving and distilling a mineral they found at the edge of some shallow lakes she had not yet visited. Gradually, the wood softened and came free, and Mary was left with the single sheet of clear brown-yellow lacquer about the size of a page from a paperback book. She polished the reverse as highly as the top until both were flat and smooth as the finest mirror. And when she looked through it, nothing in particular. It was perfectly clear, but it showed her a double image, the right one, quite close to the left and about 15 degrees upward. She wondered what would happen if she looked through two pieces, one on top of the other. So she took the Swiss Army knife again and tried to score a line across the sheet so she could cut it in two. By working and reworking, and by keeping the knife sharp on a smooth stone, she managed to score a line deep enough for her to risk snapping the sheet. She laid a thin stick under the score line and pushed sharply down on the lacquer, as she'd seen a glazier cutting glass, and it worked. Now she had two sheets. She put them together and looked through. The amber color was denser, and like a photographic filter, it emphasized some colors and held back others, giving a slightly different cast to the landscape. The curious thing was that the doubleness had disappeared, and everything was single again, but there was no sign of shadows. She moved the two pieces apart, watching how the appearance of things changed as she did so. When they were about a hand span apart, a curious thing happened. The amber coloring disappeared, and everything seemed its normal color, but brighter and more vivid. At that point, Atal came along to see what she was doing. "Can you see Sraf now?" she said. "No, but I can see other things," Mary said, and tried to show her. Atal was interested, but politely, not with a sense of discovery that was animating Mary. And presently, the Zalif tired of looking through the small pieces of lacquer and settled down on the grass to maintain her wheels and claws. Sometimes the Mulefa would groom each other's claws out of pure sociability, and once or twice Atal had invited Mary to attend to hers. Mary, in turn, let Atal tidy her hair, enjoying how the soft trunk lifted it and let it fall, stroking and massaging her scalp. She sensed that Atal wanted this now, so she put down the two pieces of lacquer and ran her hands over the astonishing smoothness of Atal's claws. That surface smoother and slicker than Teflon that rested on the lower rim of the central hole and served as a bearing when the wheel turned. The contours matched exactly, of course, and as Mary ran her hands around the inside of the wheel, she could feel no difference in texture. It was as if the Mulefa and the seed pod really were one creature, which, by a miracle, could disassemble itself and put itself together again. Atal was soothed, and so was Mary, by this contact. Her friend was young and unmarried, and there were no young males in this group, so she would have to marry a Zalif from outside. But contact wasn't easy, and sometimes Mary thought that Atal was anxious about her future. So she didn't begrudge the time she spent with her, and now she was happy to clean the wheel holes of all that dust and grime that accumulated there, and smooth the fragrant oil gently over her friend's claws, while Atal's trunk lifted and straightened her hair. When Atal had had enough, she sat herself on the wheels again, and moved away to help with the evening meal. Mary turned back to her lacquer, and almost at once she made her discovery. She held the two plates a hand span apart so that they showed that clear, bright image she'd seen before. But something had happened. As she looked through, she saw a swarm of golden sparkles surrounding the form of Atal. They were only visible through one small part of the lacquer, and then Mary realized why. At that point, she had touched the surface of it with her oily fingers. Atoll, she called. Quick, come back. Atoll turned and wheeled back. Let me take a little oil, Mary said, just enough to put on the lacquer. Atoll willingly let her run her fingers around the wheel holes again and watched curiously as Mary coated one of the pieces with a film of the clear, sweet substance. Then she pressed the plates together and moved them around to spread the oil evenly and held them a hand span apart once more. When she looked through, everything was changed. She could see shadows. Everywhere she looked, she could see gold, just as Atoll had described it. Sparkles of light, floating and drifting, and sometimes moving in a current of purpose. Among it all was the world she could see with the naked eye, the grass, the river, the trees. But wherever she saw a conscious being, one of the Mulefa, the light was thicker and full of movement. It didn't obscure their shapes in any way. If anything, it made them clearer. I didn't know it was beautiful, Mary said to Atoll. Why, of course it is, her friend replied. It is strange to think that you couldn't see it. Look at the little one. She indicated one of the small children playing in the long grass, leaping clumsily after grasshoppers, suddenly stopping to examine a leaf, falling over, scrambling up again to rush and tell his mother something, being distracted again by a piece of stick, trying to pick it up, finding ants on his trunk, and hooting with agitation. There was a golden haze around him, as there was around the shelters, the fishing nets, the evening fire. Stronger than theirs, though not by much. But unlike theirs, it was full of little swirling currents of intention that eddied and broke off and drifted about to disappear as new ones were born. Around his mother, on the other hand, the golden sparkles were much stronger, and the currents they moved in were more settled and powerful. She was preparing food, spreading flour on a flat stone, making the thin bread like chapatis or tortillas, watching her child at the same time. And the shadows, or the sraf, or the dust that bathed her, looked like the very image of responsibility and wise care. So at last, you can see, said Atoll. Thank you for listening to Places to Sleep. I hope that you've been able to drift off along the way, but if you haven't, that's okay too. I hope that sometime soon, you will find the perfect place to sleep. Or just enjoy seeing it in your mind. If you've made it this far and you're still awake and you would like to get in touch with me, you're welcome to send me a message on Twitter at Places to Sleep. That's Places, the number 2, Sleep. Good night.